So tonight we continue with Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, setting in motion the wheel of the Dharma, or turning the Dharma wheel. This is counted as the first discourse. The Buddha is freshly awakened just about 2 months previously, and he's attempting the project to teach his understanding. Goes to Usipatthana, north of Varanasi, now Sarnath, and hits upon a strategy to get through to his audience, his five companions. And as we saw last night, it's the middle way. This sense of a dynamic balance between opposites, a place of no fixed position. And gave us the example, or an illustration rather than a definition, the Eightfold Path. The path of practice, which has eight aspects, all of them equally important. So it's not that we can pick up one and neglect the rest. It's a package. And if one's in, all is in. And they need to be in balance. And so, in effect, when we're doing the meditation practice, often that's what we're doing, is we're in a balancing act of trying to get everything just right. And of course, the job is never complete, because the system is inherently dynamic. We've got it right, and it's already shifted. So we've got to start again. And then he goes on to explain the four truths. Usually, the Arya Satchani, usually translated as the Noble Truths. And we had a brief overview. They revolve around the concept of dukkha. So the first truth, this is the noble truth of dukkha. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are dukkha. Association with the unloved is dukkha, separation from the loved is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. In brief, the five aggregates associated with clinging is dukkha. So, we talked about dukkha, that sense of something missing at the core of us, that it's kind of bad emptiness that we experience at our core, something missing. So there's a gap that we need to fill. And then associated with dukkha is tanha, usually translated craving, the drivenness of the heart to fill that gap. And so the noble truth of the arising of dukkha, it is craving, which leads to further becoming, is bound up with obsession and delight, and finds its delight now here, now there, specifically craving for sense pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. And then the third truth, the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, it is the complete cessation of that very craving, abandoning it, renouncing it, releasing it, letting it go. So again, the truths illustrate the structure of the middle way, and it illustrates the structure of the dependent arising, which the Buddha awoke to. We start off with one thing, the problem. But as soon as we look at it, it expands into two things. In other words, suddenly there's a system, a dynamic system, because each of these two things depends upon the other. So if there's drivenness, there's pain. And if there's pain, there's drivenness. And they bounce off. So if we want to get rid of the pain, we don't need to work to get rid of the pain. Although we would think that's what we do. So have a good time. Make more money. What we do is the pain, we see the pain is the result, so we work on the cause, which is something other than the pain. It's the drivenness. If the drivenness drops, the pain drops. If the drivenness comes back, the pain comes back. And so they're bouncing around in this relationship. So this sense that when the Buddha looks at a something, what he sees is a dynamic relationship, or a dynamic network of relationships. He doesn't see things. He has a different way of looking at the world. So we tend to see things. So we step into this room, we look around, We see things. We see a building. We see people sitting on the floor. We see the big Buddha image. And then from that, we infer a network of relationships. This is a meditation retreat. But the Buddha would see it the other way around. He would see a network of relationships from which he would infer things, people, building, and so on. It's a different way of looking at it, where what's real isn't the thing which is in relationship. It's the relationship is most real. So it's an extremely dynamic view of the universe. And then the fourth truth, this is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of dukkha, the Noble Eightfold Path of right view, right aspiration, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right energy, right mindfulness, and right unification. So we swing around back to the Eightfold Path, which we just had before as the illustration of the middle way. So when you have a dynamic system, you have pathways within it, and yes, they double back on each other, and you find yourself back where you were before, but then you take off in a different direction, and so on. We find ourselves navigating around a dynamic system. When we meditate, that's what we're doing. We go into the mind-body process, and we start to navigate our way around. The initial method gives us the entryway, the gateway, the door. We go through that door, and things start to happen. And then the meditation starts to differentiate. So each individual heads off in a different direction. So we don't have time to look in detail at the truths, just make a couple of points. First of all, why does it begin with dukkha? And in the second truth, the Buddha talks about tanha, craving. But in the four truths, he never mentions avidya, delusion or ignorance. Why does he not mention delusion? Isn't this the root of the problem? So why does it not score a mention? I think it's because this particular discourse is about practice. It's about what to do. It's being addressed to practitioners. So the ascetics have already seen through the standard delusions of consumerism. And they've already embarked on the practice. Now, what's the starting point of the practice? The starting point is dukkha. The starting point is the recognition that there's a problem and I need to do something about it. So dukkha is about affect, feeling, what we might call emotion, but at a deep level, because from that comes action. Rather than delusion. In delusion, we don't know. So we don't know. But with dukkha, we are driven in some way. Once we recognize that we're in pain, we do something about it. Action comes from it. So this discourse is about what moves us into the practice. And of course we take a step back. What moves us, and in what direction are we moved? Am I moved towards pleasure, or am I moved towards pain? Because the normal world is moved towards pleasure. The ascetics are these crazy practitioners who are moved toward pain, because they think through pain I can break through to gain a greater happiness. So one of the underlying themes of the first discourse, although it's not explicitly mentioned, is pleasure. If pain is a central aspect, a theme, then underlying that, surely, is the question of pleasure. And one of the things that characterizes the turnaround of the Buddha's, of Siddhartha's practice before he became the Buddha, was his relationship to pleasure and pain. When he was an ascetic, and the reason why he became an ascetic, if we go back to Siddhartha before he was the Buddha, Siddhartha thought that what gets us stuck is pleasure. We get stuck in our pleasures. He felt stuck living back at home as a young aristocrat, training to take over from his dad and help govern the Shakya Republic. Siddhartha rejects all that, and he goes in pursuit of the practice of asceticism, the pursuit of pain. What he came to learn was that we can be just as stuck on pain as on pleasure. And stuckness is the problem. Dukkha is not pain, although pain could easily be dukkha. Dukkha is stuckness. Dukkha is trying to hold a fixed position within a world which is inherently mobile, inherently dynamic, which never stays still. So if I'm trying to hold to any fixed position, it's going to be painful because things are already changing. So it's harder and harder to hold on to whatever it is I'm holding on to. What I'm holding on to is not really the point. I might be holding on to pleasure. I might be holding on to my ambition to become the richest man in the world. I might be holding on to pain. I might be holding on to my ambition to become fully enlightened. It doesn't matter. It's the holding on which is the problem. It's the stuckness that's the problem. So what we need to do is to flow with events. We need to match the mobility of the world, to move with it rather than fight against it. And this requires a state of dynamic balance, which is implicit within the middle way, and which the Buddha comes to call upekkha, equanimity. And balance requires pleasure. We can't find it without pleasure. And I think this is a crucial point. When Siddhartha was still doing his ascetic practices, this comes from Mahasachika Sutta. The Buddha, in his later years, is telling his students about his past as a young practitioner, as a young fanatical practitioner. He's talking about the meditation practice that he did when he was doing his ascetic practices. He said, "I thought, suppose, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain and crush mind with mind. So, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so too, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits." In other words, in Siddhartha's world, if you didn't have rivers of sweat from the armpits, you weren't a real meditator. This is macho dharma. This is macho practice. And he's crushing the mind with the mind. He's not going to let a thought escape. He's got the lid on and he's firmly clenching it down. And teeth clenched and so on. So this is the style of practice that he had. And he says, "But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and agitated because I was exhausted by the painful striving. It didn't work, despite the fact that he had energy and he had mindfulness." Now, these are two of the factors of the Eightfold Path. If he was successful in crushing mind with mind, so he doesn't mention it here, but he also had samadhi, concentration, unification. So the three factors that you find in the Eightfold Path that talk about meditation, effort, mindfulness, unification, he had in spades. But it didn't work because it was completely out of whack. And it was out of whack because you turned the whole thing into a war. And the relationship that what he points to is his body. My body was overwrought and agitated because I was exhausted by the painful striving. His mind was clear. He's a very spiritual person. He's flogging his body to clarify the mind or the spirit or the soul or whatever. So he's dragging his body along behind him as he strives to enlightenment. Not such an unfamiliar model when you look at the world's spiritual traditions and the idea of holiness, of sainthood. One of my favourite Catholic saints is Francis of Assisi. Francis beat his body to death. He died very young. And at the end, he apologised to what he called Brother Ass that carried him around. Too bad he didn't figure this out a long time before. He might have lived a lot longer and done a lot of good. But he beat himself to death. And because I was raised as a Catholic, a lot of the saints in the Catholic tradition are people who basically work themselves to death. Mm-hmm. Holy workaholism. And this is what the Buddha was into. Siddhartha, he was not the Buddha. This is what he was into. And it's the practice of one who is driven. So it's the practice of one who is possessed by tanha, by craving. Because tanha or craving is shorthand for the state of being driven. And where there's tanha, there's dukkha. Where there's drivenness, there's pain. So it didn't work. So what turned him around when he realised it wasn't working and he started to reflect? He had the honesty to recognise when something wasn't working. So he stopped and started to reflect, what's going on? And what turned him around was a spontaneous memory from childhood and what that memory taught him. And this is his recollection of it. I recall that when my father, the Shakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I attained and lived in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained application, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization that is the path to awakening. This is a very famous story, which over the time got more and more elaborated. Usually when you hear it, it's the later versions that you get. The earliest version, which is this, is the most plain. Very little is specified. He was all it was that he was young, and he was sitting under in the cool shade of a rose apple tree while his father was working, was occupied, working presumably. So, a very simple domestic scene.
Wasn't it a player?
That's the later stories.
That's later.
Yeah. Here it just says his father was occupied.
In comic book.
Yeah, in the comic book, that's what it's got. It's a story about, because the later commentators are trying to reconcile Siddhartha is a prince, his father is a king, so what's the king doing to be outside being occupied? He must have been some ceremony. So he must have been doing the ploughing ceremony, and the royal family were there, and the prince was
ploughing
festival. Yeah. So turning the soil for the first time.
Yeah.
But maybe he was just out there working. So he has this memory of a spontaneously arising state of samadhi, which comes from and is associated with pleasure. And that is the key point. We won't go into the whole business about what is jhana and so on. This takes us into a hugely controversial area in contemporary Theravada, and very, very controversial and very technical, and we're not going to go there. We're just going to say he attained a very pleasurable state of absorption quite spontaneously sitting under this tree, and it happened in his childhood. He then, as an adult, asked himself a question, and it was this question and the answer to it that turned him around and set him on the road to the Bodhi tree. I thought, why am I afraid of pleasure? That has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. I thought, I am not afraid of pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states. Really interesting question. Why am I afraid of pleasure? This is the question that turned him around. Pleasure allows for the balance that allows us to de-stick ourselves, to get unstuck. At this point in Siddhartha's life, at this crisis, when he's realised that what he's been doing is the wrong path, it's just a dead end, he's already rejected pleasure. Or rather, he's rejected a certain kind of pleasure, that the pleasure of the household life, which is characterised in his view by what he calls nandi, delight. When, in Four Truths, when the Buddha talks about the arising of dukkha, it is craving which leads to further becoming is bound up with obsession and delight, and finds its delight now here, now there. What's he getting at with delight? Nandi in Pali. If and why, even when he questions why am I afraid of pleasure, does he still think that sensual pleasures are to be avoided? Why am I afraid of pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? What's he getting at? What he means by sensual pleasure is stimulus-driven pleasure. So pleasure which is entirely dependent upon a temporary stimulus. So, pick a pleasure. A nice sip of wine, nice toke, nice cup of coffee, nice TV show, nice scoopers. Take the stimulus, the pleasure arises. Now, when the pleasure arises, what's the obvious? And there's a satisfaction in that. What's the obvious response? That was nice. I'd like to do it again. So take another one. That was nice. Why didn't I do it again? That was nice. I think I'll try it again. That was still pretty good. I think I'll try it again. Delight, nandi, is the satisfaction that arises from the gratification that arises from satisfying a pleasure which contains within it the desire to do it again. So nandi, or delight, for the Buddha implies repetition, endless repetition, again and again and again and again and again and again. I think the Divinals, a lot of you, or some of you may be too young to know who I'm talking about, saying it's a fine line between pleasure and pain. When something feels good, you want to do it again. And if I think that the person who sang that was at the time a heroin addict. It is a fine line between pleasure and pain. And when something feels good, we do want to do it again. And that's nandi. And it leads to addiction, it leads to exhaustion, it leads to boredom, it leads to futility. It leads to a desperate search for another stimulus of some other kind. So it has a quality of restlessness. As the Buddha says, it finds its delight now here, now there. It's restless. It's constantly shifting target. That was good, but I'm getting bored with that. I've got to get something else now. That was great. I'll put that aside because it's getting a bit tedious. I'll go for this one instead. Again and again and again. Consumerism. That's what it's all about. So that kind of pleasure does not result in the kind of balance required to get unstuck. It just gets us more stuck. So the Buddha is talking about a different kind of pleasure, a pleasure that is free from tanha, free from drivenness. And that's the significance of that memory. As a child, he recognized that pleasure. It was exquisite, and it was completely free of drivenness. It just did not have that driven quality to it. So the Buddha, so Siddhartha, turns away from his ascetic practices, and he starts looking for pleasure. But pleasure, a new kind of pleasure, or a different relationship to pleasure. A pleasure that has a childlike quality of spontaneity to it. A willingness to accept what the world offers before the time of disillusionment. And this association with childhood is, I think, very significant. In the 20th century, Freud developed the rather perverse concept of polymorphous perversity. This is what he called the pleasure that comes from a child's sensuality. That when we're children, the sensual pleasure that we feel, it's a pleasure through the senses, but it's not concentrated on any particular location or any particular object. It's general. And this is the spontaneous pleasure that we have as children, but which we lose as we grow older. And it's also interesting that in the Buddhist teachings, of course, you have a whole series of different worlds. You have realms beneath the human realm, various hell realms, and worlds above the human world, deva realms, heaven realms. The lower heaven realms are occupied by devas, the gods, who spend their time enjoying pleasures, sense pleasures. And rebirth in one of these heavens is traditionally regarded as quite desirable. It's like you can take a samsaric break for a while. Phew. Just hang out here for a couple of eons and enjoy myself before going back to the rubbish. Now, the devas appear in Buddhist literature in a number of different ways. And it's interesting to look at them because they illustrate what the Buddha is getting at when he's talking about pleasure. Devas are sensual beings, but they are not sexual. They don't reproduce sexually. If you're reborn into a heaven, you're spontaneously born. You die, and then suddenly, boom, you're sitting in a heaven realm with a perfect 16-year-old body. Apparently, in ancient India, it was felt you peaked at 16, adorned with beautiful jewellery, and with a pleasure palace in front of you, and you were ready to party. And you partied. You didn't muck about. Teenage party time up in the heavens. There's some really nice stories. One of my favourites is this young monk who was really intense with his practice. He was determined to get enlightened. And he drove himself in his practice. And he drove himself to the point that he's meditating and he just parks it. He just dies. And the first he knows of it, because he's in deep samadhi, is he's meditating away, and then someone taps him on the shoulder, disturbing him. What? And he looks up, and there's the most gorgeous woman he has ever seen in his entire life. And it takes all of his self-control to keep his eyes from bulging out of their sockets. And he says, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" "Oh, no." And he's just staring at her in shock. And she says, "It's time to come home now." And he says, "What are you talking about?" And she says, "You've been here long enough. It's time to come home. Everybody's waiting for you." And he says, "What are you talking about? I don't have a home. I'm a bhikkhu." And she says, "You do have a home. It's over there." And he looks, And there's this magnificent palace. And in every window, there's a gorgeous woman. And he says, I can't go there. I'm a bhikkhu. And she says, no, you're not. And he says, yes, I am. And she says, take a look. And he looks down. Perfect 16-year-old body. Not a sign of a robe. Jewels. And he thinks, oh, my God, I've gone and died. And fortunately, it's only seconds within this new birth. So he's got enough memory of what happened before to realise what he's in deep trouble. So he rockets down to earth and appears before the Buddha, who fortunately could teach Devas. And he says, you've got to help me. You've got to help me. I'm in heaven. And so the Buddha gives him a teaching, and then the Deva attains the first stage of awakening, which means that he's now on the path and he's going to get there. He goes, phew, rockets back and starts departing. The problem with being a Deva is you very quickly forget the past. You're so caught up with the party. Now, the thing about these Devas is, being spontaneously reborn, they don't reproduce sexually, they don't have sex. They do have erotic friendships. So male and female Devas will pair off. And they will do things like they will hold hands, they will take walks together, they will look into each other's eyes, they will play music to each other, they will go for rides together, they will be companions, but they don't have sex. It's a very interesting view of pleasure. They are sensual, but they are not sexual. This kind of pleasure is a model for the kind of pleasure that the Buddha is talking about, that Siddhartha was groping for after he had that memory. I came across this whole idea a couple of years ago when I was teaching in Malaysia at a place called Sasanaraka Buddhist Sanctuary. It comes out of a learned book called Nirvana and Other Buddhist Felicities. And the writer, Stephen Collins, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, is talking about, because he's gone through the literature, he's talking about this whole business about pleasure. And I thought, this sounds really interesting. I've got to check it out. And at the time I checked it out, the first time I tried, was during the lunch break in the retreat. Now, this monastery / meditation centre is in the hills above Taiping. It's in roughly mid-peninsula Malaysia. The hills are covered with rainforest. They are beautiful. And the monastery is right as you enter into the rainforest. To get up from the town, you've got to get into a four-wheel drive to get up there. And the dining hall, everything's on a slope. The dining hall is built so that it's open to the view facing, I think, south. And you look out, and all you can see are these magnificent valleys and peaks covered with rainforest, clouds drifting. It's beautiful. And the people would lay out the special table for me, and I'd be sitting there and lay out food. And the meditators were all doing quite well. They've got good samadhi. And it's lunchtime, so I can relax. Because the atmosphere in the eating hall is really, really nice. It's very peaceful. Like, by this stage of the retreat, they're right into it. I have no sense of responsibility. I can take a break. I can just enjoy it. And I just opened up. No localization. Just, I'm sitting here in the midst of this landscape. And it was very pleasurable. It was very pleasurable. Nothing specific. Nothing to hook onto. But the whole thing, the whole package, was really, really pleasurable. And before me is the spread. Very nice food there. So, better start eating. So, look down. Oh, that looks good. Oh, that looks good. Grab the utensils. Shove it in. Up. Into the gob. Chew, chew, chew. Swallow. Oh, that's good. And again. Up into the gob, chew, 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 swallow, and so on. It was very good food. It was a very pleasurable activity. It was not as pleasurable as the pleasure before. It was very focused on that particular site, on that particular part of the body, on that this particular activity, and it contained, along with the focus, an element of agitation.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get the next one. Got to get the next one. Keep shoveling it down. It was a very nice meal, and I enjoy eating. It was not as pleasurable as just sitting there and just being there. Yet that other pleasure is hard to pinpoint because it isn't a specific thing. I talk about the view. It was magnificent. It wasn't any one particular part of the view, or it was the atmosphere as well, literally the atmosphere, the air, like the air agrees with me. I mean, it was the whole package. And it wasn't localized in any particular part of the body. It was wide open. And I thought, this is what he's getting at. So I've been practicing it since. And I think it works. What Siddhartha discovered, and then later, I think, taught in terms of the kinds of pleasure that one needs to cultivate. First of all, one needs pleasure. If we're going to succeed in the meditation project, we need to enjoy it. For years, I did meditation as a bitter medicine that I had to take. I didn't enjoy it, but I knew I had to do it, so I did it. And it took a long time before I began to twig that if I actually start to enjoy it, the whole process moves on a lot more easily and a lot more readily. I know it's obvious, I know it's a bit thick, but what to do? It took me a while to figure it out.
Catholicism.
I don't blame Catholicism. Catholics know how to enjoy themselves. And so I've come to accept this. And when I do a retreat, the first thing I do, basically, is to start to enjoy myself. I treat every retreat as a holiday. And it's not, I'm not looking for pleasure. Because if I look for it, I start to grab. And then it's just, everything gets tight. It's rather, I let the pleasure come to me. It's more like an opening up. So this, I find quite pleasurable, this atmosphere here, you know, the sun setting, everything getting darker, the sound outside, again the air, the moisture, the warmth, the kind of mixture of warmth and cool, the peacefulness after some days of being here. It's like I feel like I'm beginning to arrive. I can actually be here and open up to it. The sense of, you know, I'm now familiar with the environment. I don't have to rush anywhere. I've got nothing particular to do. There's nothing in particular to grab. It's just here. And it's pleasurable. It's subtle. It's nothing too specific to hold to. But there is a pleasure in it. And it's important to open up to that. Because that gives me the foundation for finding that balance. If I'm grabbing, if I'm driven, it vanishes. If, for example, I'm meditating and I'm grabbing for a result, it vanishes. If on the other extreme, if I'm slack, if I slack it off and lose my connection with this, what is happening in the present, I lose the pleasure too. Very easy to lose it. It's a balance. But when I find the pleasure, I find the balance. And it makes the whole thing flow much more smoothly. And as this relationship to pleasure, as I said, that turns Siddhartha around, the path itself must be pleasurable. It must generate contentment. Otherwise, it's not going to work. So we need, in some real felt sense, the feeling that we don't need to look further than this, which is happening now. We don't need to hold on to any particular thing, any particular experience. So the path is the destination in some sense. It's the path is dynamic, it's moving, yet it's also the place we're moving to. They become one. When Siddhartha was crushing mind with mind, he must have been doing so because he was looking for a result. He was looking for what would happen next. And what would happen next would justify all that sweat running from his armpits. And it doesn't work, because that very action is driven. It's tanha. So our relationship to time is important. It's not that the payoff comes later. It comes now. And when we start to tune into this, then the path itself starts to really unfold. As one discourse, Bhadekarata Sutta, in which there's a poem in which the mature Buddha, I think, talks about this this whole thing. He says, he's talking about what we call insight meditation. He says, "Do not run after the past, nor long for the future. What is past is left behind. The future is not yet reached. Instead, see deeply into each presently arisen phenomenon, not sucked in, not shaken off. This is how you cultivate understanding." So, first of all, he talks about time. Do not run after the past, nor long for the future. What is past is left behind. The future is not yet reached. So first, sort out our relationship to time, recognizing that past and future actually don't exist. They are simply images in the mind that occur now. But the body and the mind respond to those images. We lean after those images. We grab hold of the past. It wasn't so good. We want to improve it. We cling to the future. I'm going to get this right. Later there'll be the payoff. So they become more real to us than this. So we've got to work on our relationship to time. Instead, see deeply into each presently arisen phenomenon. So the present is dynamic. Phenomena arise, and they keep arising, and they keep ceasing. Everything is changing. Everything is dynamic. When he says see deeply, this is a translation of the Pali verb vipassati. We're familiar with the idea of insight meditation and with the idea of insight and having an insight. And in both cases, insight is a noun. It's a thing. But what we don't get, what isn't so apparent to us, but which is quite clear in the Pali, is that there is the verb to insight. Vipassati, from which we get the noun vipassana. So insight isn't a thing that we might have or not have. Insight is an activity. It's something that we do or alternatively don't do. But it's something that we do. It's a practice. We don't wait for insight to happen. We insight our experience. We insight each presently arisen phenomenon. We can only insight what's in the present. We can't insight anything that happened before or anything that will happen later. What the Buddha means by insight is a whole separate Dharma talk. But briefly, what it revolves around is the perception of impermanence. Again, dynamism. The fact that everything is already changing. So, seeing into experience in a way that totally accepts the fact of change and is alert to it. So the insight meditator is interested in the fact that things change and interested in the points of change. So, for example, when we're talking in the Four Truths, we've got craving or drivenness and dukkha or pain. So there's a relationship between drivenness and pain. With the arising of drivenness, pain arises. With the cessation of drivenness, pain ceases. It's a dynamic relationship in which things are coming and going. It's impermanent. It's changing. If we're not sensitive to the fact of change, we won't see this relationship. So insight meditation is all about seeing relationships, which means seeing change as it unfolds now. So instead, see deeply into each presently arisen phenomenon, not sucked in, not shaken off. So to get sucked into it is to identify with whatever comes up. As soon as I identify with the experience, I'm sucked in. To be shaken off is perhaps aversion. God, don't like that one. Got to get out of here. Or perhaps restlessness. I'm not quite sure what exactly he's getting at. This is a poem, after all. That particular line I'm just taking directly from Tinisaro's translation. But you can see that what it's getting at is maintaining a balance. Don't get sucked in. Don't be shaken off. But just maintain the balance. That's the crucial thing. And the whole thing is moving already. So the balance that I had 5 minutes ago isn't necessarily going to work now. The balance that I had 5 seconds ago isn't necessarily going to work now. It's inherently dynamic. This is how you cultivate understanding. And this whole process is fun. It's pleasurable. Even the hard bits are actually quite pleasurable. One time when I, in my Zen days, back in the early 80s, I did a lot of Zen retreats. And one time I remember reflecting, why do I keep going back and doing these, even though they're so difficult? And I realised it was because when I get into the meditation practice, things become real. It's like in my ordinary life, I become aware of the fact that I was living, as it were, behind a veil. Essentially of concept. It's like there was a sticky something between me and what was going on. And the only time that this dropped away was when I was doing a retreat. It might hurt, but at least it's real. Mm-hmm. And there was a satisfaction that came from that. There was a pleasure that came from that. So I think it's important in the meditation practice, learning from Siddhartha's experience, to learn to enjoy it. It's to take a childlike, spontaneous pleasure in what we're doing. And certainly there's a certain childlike quality about the meditation retreat. We're all like little kiddies running around the schoolyard. Anyway, so we may as well enjoy ourselves as we do it. And with finding pleasure within it is a major step along the way. Okay, that's enough for tonight. What we'll do tomorrow is to look at the whole issue of truth. We're looking at the four truths, which the Buddha introduced in the first discourse. And so tomorrow we'll look at the whole question of truth. What is truth from the Buddha's perspective? And possibly move on to the second discourse. Yeah, you have a question?
Could you go to know about sutta that you were just reading from, the nice
resume? The poem. Oh. Baddeka Ratta. BHADDEKARATTA. It's in Majjhima Nikaya number 131. Bhikkhu Bodhi has a slightly different translation.
Way different, actually.
Yeah. And I can't. I've looked at the Pali, but I can't figure out.
I think it's Nyanamoli. I think it's not really Bhikkhu Bodhi.
Nyanamoli's translation. You think Bhikkhu Bodhi just repeated?
He just said okay.
Yeah. Tadisaros is much more interesting. So I'm just going along with him. Yeah, Christine. Yeah, they're being recorded as we speak, that little black box there, and they'll be going up on the website. Okay, are we done?
Will they be freely available?
Yeah, that's just free download. Yeah.
That's not the Buddha made.
No, it's my website. The Dharma Salon.
I'll make sure I have that before I go home.
Yeah. I've got my card, it's got all the details, but it's a salon. It's not where you get your hair cut. It's where you chat about Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And if you added an extra O, you could drink alcohol. But there isn't the extra O. Just remember that. Okay.